this is Vladimir Kushner, the chair of the ACG Innovation and Technology Committee, and I would like to welcome you back to the Brains and Guts podcast, which focuses on GI innovation. We're back from our mid-season break with a new episode on fundraising and market analysis. Today, we are excited to share the first of two conversations with the entrepreneurs behind Monarch Partners, who have helped bring many successful GI products to the market. They will take us through the commercialization process, risk evaluation, and what innovators need to do before seeking funding. And now, I would like to introduce my co-host, Dr. Topic Kachami, and start the conversation.
Thank you, Vlad. I'm very excited today to introduce our three guests from Monarch Partners, who have over 75 years of combined medical device experience. The majority of that, over 50 years, is in gastroenterology. They have played a pivotal role in many of the commercial successes that we today use. Some of these you are probably very familiar with. Things like double balloon enteroscopy, cholangioscopy, Cellvizio, the Beacon Needle platform known today as the Charcot, the Axis stent, and many more. They now are full-time entrepreneurs building the next wave of innovative companies and technology through a proven process that they will share with us today and give us their insights and their expertise. It is our pleasure to introduce Jeremy Starkweather, Jason Yolzardi, and John Wayne from Monarch Partners. And gentlemen, if you can start by giving us an introduction of what you really do, or maybe what you call the elevator pitch as to who the Monarch Partners are.
Thanks for the introduction, Tufik and Vlad. We really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your audience. Before forming Monarch Partners, as you mentioned, we played pivotal roles in the commercial success of some of the most impactful technologies in the GI space over the past two decades. This gave us a platform to establish deep relationships among the industry and industry thought leaders. It's also where we learned what great looks like. In its simplest form, Monarch Partners builds companies. We're a medical device company in a box, if you will. Our secret sauce is actually our collective mindset as an executive leadership team. For every venture, we roll up our sleeves and apply those insights every step along the way, from concept to commercialization. Whether it's an organically grown technology or the invention from an outside party, our vision is to create a robust portfolio of innovative companies by leveraging our experience, partners, and strategic relationships.
Thank you, Jason, for this introduction. You know, we are doing these series of podcast for the novice innovator as a 101 of innovation. Up to now, we have talked about why innovate. And we've also talked about, if you have an idea, how to philosophically approach bringing it to market. We had an introduction on the finances, and we also had an introduction to patents. We were hoping to benefit from your expertise and take a slightly deeper dive into the process. Maybe starting by talking about how do you evaluate an idea or a product in terms of opportunity and risk, and how do you evaluate it, go through market analysis, and then evaluate the clinical, technical aspect, regulatory aspects, and then how do you approach it from the operations standpoint. So maybe we can start by talking about, you know, someone approaches you with an idea or a product. How do you look at this as an opportunity, and how do you evaluate the risk?
Yeah, Tufik, I'll kick things off and then I'll pass it on to John and Jeremy. Really at the highest level, we like to do, as you mentioned, an overall risk and opportunity assessment. Basically at the highest level, what does the market look like and how hard would it be to commercialize? So the way we like to break things down are into a couple different categories. As you mentioned, we'll touch upon market analysis, the clinical risks, what are the technical risks, and then what are the regulatory risks. So just real briefly, the first thing we like to look into is, like, what's the market for? Like, what problem are you trying to solve and who's going to use it? So in that process, we like to dive into what the typical user requirements would be from not only the doctors, but also the nurses and techs. And then what does it look like commercially post FDA? So I'll pass along to John. He could talk about market modeling. touch upon investor strategic interest, and then we'll go to Jeremy with the other things.
Yeah, sure. Thank you guys for having us on the podcast. I really appreciate the opportunity. So as Jason indicated, it's really important to have a sense of the market opportunity early in the process. It serves as an important basis for discussion with investors and strategics, or in the process through which you may seek grant funding, that kind of thing. And it's really fundamental to the value of the technology. And oftentimes inventors will assume that the market's a given, and that investors and strategics in particular, if they've got some familiarity with the GI space, which is somewhat of the context for this discussion, will clearly see the opportunity. But it's really on the party seeking the funding or the engagement with the strategic to do the legwork on clearly laying out the market specifics and how that translates into a pathway for a new medical device concept. Also, we're sometimes looking at what we believe are ostensibly large markets, but they can in fact be much smaller when you translate disease prevalence into procedure volumes and that kind of thing. When you start to look at it from the standpoint of the various patient segments that may actually be a recipient of the new technology that's at hand. So those markets can sometimes be much smaller than you may initially think. And that, of course, translates into the number of medical devices that could be sold in a year. So those are really important factors to consider early on and make sure that you've got a handle on that kind of thing as you're beginning to embark on discussions with parties that might be investing money or putting money behind a new medical device concept.
So, John, would you mind elaborating a little bit on what factors go into the market analysis? So I'm hearing you say the prevalence of the disease, how many procedures, like how much is built for the device during the procedure? Is that part of your market analysis?
Yeah, absolutely. The reimbursement and economics around a given procedure are very important. It of course ties into whether or not a new medical device that is being introduced to the market would make money for a hospital, lose money for a hospital, and it can be of course very difficult to sell something that that's going to lose money, notwithstanding the clinical benefit. Of course, you know that's always a balance. So yeah, the reimbursement and the economics around it are very important. And then when it comes to understanding more broadly what the market may look like, a good starting point is to think about whether or not the technology concept is it an alternative to an existing treatment, in which case you may have some existing procedure volumes that are a good starting point. You could ask the question of whether or not the new concept would expand the number of treatments because it's easier, it's more accessible to a broader range of physicians due to perhaps not quite as high of a technical skill set that's required. You could also think of it in terms of population and incidence of a given condition when, say, a treatment does not already exist and you're bringing something novel that would give an option to patients that currently aren't treated with a medical device. And then it's good to think about the uptake of a new technology in terms of what's required to deploy that medical device concept, in particular when you're thinking globally and in regions that may not have the same kind of infrastructure that we have in the United States or some of the larger European countries that people oftentimes think about with respect to the main medical device markets.
Perfect. Thank you for clarifying that. So the competitive landscape is part of that opportunity.
Yeah, sure. I mean, anytime you're thinking about bringing a concept to market, you think about it in terms of the market share, in terms of the number of procedures that your concept may be used in versus an alternative. And of course, the more crowded a space is with various alternatives, the more of an effort or potential limit there is on the potential share that you could achieve, and that of course tracks back to the overall economics associated with the opportunity. And those economics are once again the basis of the conversation that are had with investors and strategics or any other party that may be looking to put funding behind a given medical device technology.
Okay. And so John says, hey, the market analysis is favorable on this product. What would be the next step for you?
Yeah, let me jump in here and provide a little bit of insight around risk associated with like the clinical, the technical, and the regulatory side. You know, first things first, does the market want it? I also think that it's critical for inventors to have an idea of what they want to do. Do they want to build a company? Do they want to just take a technology and license it? Let's say it's coming out of a university to one of the few strategics that we have in the GI endoscopy space, because there's only a handful of players. But after you have that, yes, we know that we want to, what we want to do here. We want to sell the company, for example. That's where the go-to-market strategy that Jason and I a lot of times work on comes into play. You have to have this market modeling piece that John just spoke of, but you really also need to then say, okay, technically, what is it going to take to bring this technology from this concept to a finished good? And we're going to commercialize it now. If it, there's some times where you technically can't do what you want the product to do. So there needs to be some level of assessment there. And a lot of times what we will do is we'll do that early technology assessment with engineering partners to say, okay, yes, this checks the technical box from a risk perspective. You know, it's gonna be reasonable to design. It's gonna be reasonable to manufacture, which is a big deal because that drives what your future average selling price is going to be, the ASP. You know, you can't take an existing, you know, clinical space and, you know, quadruple the price unless you've got tremendous clinical benefit. So that technical risk assessment can only be done with the people that are ultimately going to engineer and manufacture it. So that becomes a very critical part. You know, luckily, if you are in some settings, you might have some engineering resources that can help you out. If you don't have those engineering resources to help you out, you're probably going to have to find some funding. So you're either going to have to bring some of your own money, or you're going to have to get a grant, or you're going to have to find some friends and families to kick in some cash. So one thing that you could have the greatest idea ever. If it's not manufacturable at a reasonable cost, it's never going to be commercializable because you just can't get there. And there needs to be appropriate margins. If your goal is to sell your technology to a company, there's going to be margin expectations that are largely driven around the technical aspects of the device. If you get past that hurdle, then you really got to start thinking clinically, okay, what are we going to have to do as we go down this pathway to show that we've got a clinical benefit? It could be that you have to do a very large study to show that you truly have a clinical benefit. If it's marginal benefit, you could spend a lot of money on, you know, a large clinical trial to do that. That doesn't even account for all the preclinical work that you need to do with GLP studies that is going to be a requirement by the FDA. And then finally, you get into, hey, what is the regulatory path? So is there a predicate? Am I doing something that's completely new? And that's based on a lot on safety and efficacy, obviously. So, you know, if you have something that the FDA is going to be viewed as high risk from a safety standpoint, you could find yourself in a PMA environment, which is going to require much more evidence related to clinical trials. If you are just a little bit different than a predicate, you might have to do a large de novo trial. That's actually what we experienced at Exlumina to get the regulatory approval for the Axio stent. There was no predicate. Nobody had created that type of product in the GI endoscopy space. So that required a de novo trial, meaning you can't point to another device in the market that is exactly like that. The easiest pathway is that there's a clear predicate. Maybe you're going to be second, third, or maybe even fourth into the market. And so what has the predicate done? Did they have to do a large trial to prove efficacy? You probably are going to be required by the FDA to do that. So when you take those three key points, you've done the market analysis, you've got a go-to-market strategy, you've got a clinical, reasonable clinical risk and technical risk and regulatory risk, that is when your concept actually becomes fundable. Because if your concept is not fundable to the investor, it is going to be very difficult to get it off the ground. So I'll wrap up my comments with that, because this is what it's all about from going from concept to commercialization. It requires all of these aspects. And the earlier you do that, actually, the less money you probably will have to raise, because you won't have hiccups along the way. And it becomes critical to everything.
Wow, Jeremy, you covered so many things. I have so many questions.
We can hit them one by one.
Yeah, the first question. Yeah, Vlad, go ahead, please.
Oh, no, I was just going to go back to the beginning, and that's market analysis. So, you know, I think we all in the GI space are familiar with products and, you know, categories of products that have really gotten pretty far, but for various reasons, the market analysis didn't account for the hurdles that were going to be encountered once they've gotten to practice. I'm thinking about endobariatrics, for example, where there's just tremendous financial barriers and also the regulatory difficulties. So who do you involve in the market analysis for a new product, and kind of, you know, how is it as soon as you get a provisional patent, you start working with somebody, and what fields do you get the people from that are going to be helping you with the market analysis to make sure that you're getting sound advice and also getting, you know, all important perspectives?
I'll chime in first, and then I'm sure Jeremy, John, will have a perspective. There's really two big buckets that we first lean on, in my opinion, Vlad and Tufik. The first, actually, you know, the good news about spending our entire careers in the industry is we actually lean on what we would know and think to be as something that's going to be a sound technology in the market or something that's not. I think when you have enough subject matter expertise, our initial filter is a pretty strong indicator of whether something makes sense or not. You'll be surprised at how many times we have a gut impression about something when we first hear about it, and it ends up being true or something that we either do or do not invest in our time and energy in. The second one is KOLs like yourself, Tufik and Vlad, we like to lean on our network to get their opinions about it. So after our opinion has been vetted, we like to go to the people that are going to use the technologies and get their impressions on, hey, if you had a technology like this tomorrow, does it solve one of your problems that you face? And we really want to get validation from that exercise first, after we do our own assessment, and then we go from there.
Yeah, I'll add on to that. I think finding an industry person that can help you out, that's got some experience in the space, is critical. You know, you guys have a lot of relationships just because you have a lot of people knocking on your door daily. It's a little bit tough to introduce these products at a super early stage to a strategic. So, you know, you have to lean on somebody. I will say that even probably, but even, you know, as you're in the idea phase in the provisional IP kind of landscape, it's good to start getting some of that opinion, because you could spend a lot of time and effort, you know, engineering, doing some engineering work, setting up the provisional patent, and then, you know, come to find out this really doesn't have a place. So I'll give you an example of, I don't have a specific example, but let's say that you have a real pain point in your clinical practice and you're like, man, I've got an idea that is going to be ideal to solve this problem, and it's going to help me out. I've had physicians come to me before with that type of idea, and I'm like, okay, what does it look like? How often does that happen to you? And sometimes the answer to that is, oh yeah, it only happens, you know, once a month. Well, if you got a problem that only happens to you once a month, and you're trying to come up with a technology solution that's only going to solve your problem in a very minimal amount of your clinical practice, It could be that when you get to the market assessment, market modeling phase, that it's not a fundable thing. So I think early feedback from industry, really looking exactly what problem you're solving and how can that impact the market is critical. You know, there is ways to communicate things with people before provisional patent. You can have them sign an NDA. Make sure that it's not publicly available. You know, don't go to your next conference and present your new idea before you've got it covered. But go to trusted people, have them sign confidentiality, and start sharing some ideas. Sometimes you can get to know fast, which is beneficial because inventors are definitely going to end up having another great idea. So, and also don't fall in love with your idea. Make sure that you're getting plenty of outside voices. And that's where, you know, we take an idea that comes to us. If we're feeling good about it, we would ask the inventor's permission to go start to socialize that with other people in the market, primarily expert gastroenterologists that deal with that same problem every single day.
Yeah, and if I could build on what Jeremy and Jason just described, I think it's crucial to ask the questions to the right types of people, including clinicians, expert clinicians, people on the industry side, but it's just as important to be asking the right types of questions that are really holistic in nature, and that may uncover limitations that that you may not immediately think of. You know, there's the clinical need, of course, and I think that's where people's heads go early on in the assessment. But there are also workflow considerations and technical considerations related to getting the concept to patients. And that may have to do with where the patients are treated. Are they treated in the hospital? Or are they treated in the office? Some other site where is that physician who would do the procedure? Do they have a presence there? And then there are the economics. And then those three things, those three sort of categories can translate into what we were talking about earlier on, which is the overall market opportunity and what those economics look like and the risk involved. And so if something's got a large opportunity and a reasonable risk profile, then that's a very fundable and actionable type of a project. Conversely, if you're asking those questions and it appears to be a difficult road and there will be a lot of risk, and if perhaps the opportunity, the market opportunity is not that big, maybe that's not the best balance of risk to return. So the more you can ask those questions early on before you deploy any sort of capital, whether it's towards the intellectual property or anything else, the better off you're going to be, because those are the questions that ultimately inform how much capital you'll need and what's required to execute. And that amount of capital, the things that are required to execute, the timing related to that execution, those are all important factors to understand as early on in the process as possible.
Thank you for sharing that. So I want to make sure we clarify something for the listener. You know, and Jeremy, especially you said, you know, now the product becomes fundable. So in your mind, can you tell us the steps that an inventor has to do on their own before they pitch the product and before it's what you said, fundable? So you talked about, for example, understanding the regulatory requirement. Sometimes that requires a lot of expertise where it could need funding. But what you would prefer is for the inventor to do some of that work before they come to you and have an understanding of the landscape. What are these three, four things you want to see before the investor, before the inventor comes to you and say, help me get funding?
Yeah, I actually believe that you come to people that know the space before you even think about funding. For example, if you have somebody that's got deep knowledge of the space, very quickly you can figure out if something is going to have a really hard regulatory pathway. Okay. Somebody, you don't have to be a regulatory expert to look up, you know, technologies, you know, a summary of their filing You can get that. It's all readily available. So you can do a lot of research about the regulatory aspect of this yourself, or with somebody that you trust to share the idea with. A lot of times you're probably going to know, you might not know the nuances of the regulatory pathway, but you're going to know something, meaning, okay, I'm using this product for this clinical application. Could there be dramatic improvements in that product and there be a clinical benefit for doing something just better than that product? In that scenario, you're like, okay, there's probably a predicate there, which means you have a regulatory pathway that is going to be easier. If you have a game-changing invention that you've never seen in your life, you got a tougher regulatory pathway. So you can kind of start to understand it, because it can actually be the difference in a project taking 2, 3, 4 years or a project taking 8 years. We've all seen the challenges in different areas of GI. Bariatrics is a great one. GERD is a great one. Jason and I were with Medigus, and that was a flexible endostapler for GERD. And we know the players that are in GERD right now, and we've seen their pathway and how long that those companies have existed. And some of those companies have had to raise $100, $200, even $300 million. And so if you've got something that is completely new, you can expect a long pathway, and you can also expect a massive amount of funding. So even with Medigus, it was the product was incredible, probably the most well-engineered product that I've ever seen, but it wasn't perfect. We tried to work it. What ended up happening also against us at Medigus was patient recruitment. That talks about the workflow that John's kind of talk about. You know, can you recruit enough patients in a space to get to profitability someday? All those things are tiny nuances that have to be done in a full assessment. You don't have to go that deep in the initial phase, but you need to be somewhere in the right universe of whether it's going to be a difficult regulatory path. In my own personal opinion, regulatory and proving clinical evidence are the two most difficult things that any technology will face. There are incredible engineers out there that can solve most problems, but those are, in my opinion, can be deal killers. The good thing about the GI endoscopy space is you typically can fit in to this non-PMA lane and make a product that dramatically is better than maybe what exists, and just get great engineering and bring your idea to life. So it's not all doom and gloom. Did that answer your question?
It did. You know, one thing you mentioned was, for example, you talked about the Exlumina experience and said we ended up having to go through the PMA. So was something like this evident to you all at the beginning and you factored in, or
no,
were you hoping?
I just want to correct real quick. It wasn't a PMA. It was a de novo classification. And a de novo classification means that it's relatively reasonable risk from a patient safety and efficacy standpoint, but it does not have a predicate. So it could be an incredible invention. We all love Dr. Ben Muller. He came up with a truly incredible product, but there was nothing like it. So he had a little bit more challenging regulatory pathway. You can figure that out. I'm sure that in the beginning, it was very clear to Dr. Ben Muller that there was no product like this.
When
you have that type of a situation where there's no product like it, and you think it can be deemed a good clinical and regulatory risk, it becomes very, very valuable. And we've all seen what that technology has done over the years. So that's a good example of something that had moderate risk from like a clinical and regulatory perspective. And then you just execute on the technical and you have what he did.
Yep, an amazing product.
Thank you for listening to Brains and Guts, the GI Innovation Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, please subscribe and drop us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also send us questions and ideas for future episodes to brainsandguts@gi.org. We look forward to talking to you soon.